Welcome to another episode of Tools, Talents, and Techniques, and I am very excited for this episode. I'm excited for every episode. I get to talk to such wonderful people doing cool things, but I've been especially looking forward to this one. Mac, welcome to the show. Just give a brief thumbnail of who you are and a little bit about what you currently do.
Sure. Well, thank you for having me. It's a welcome to see. Very nice to see you again. So a little background on me. I'm a super nerd. Most of my life, I've been taking things apart and then try to figure out how to put them back together. I started as a toddler, as a kid, and took my crib apart, and then never stopped. So, you know, I kind of got into computers when I was a young age, started with a Commodore 64, and never stopped programming and taking things apart from that as well. I even took that apart. My mom really got mad at me for that because she's like, I hope it still works. They spent a lot of money on me getting me that. So, you know, I'm just been in technology all my life. I went to school for computer science. I've done a lot of ethical hacking and cyber work mixed with the software and IT stuff. So I kind of between all three of those is with my career for the last 10 years. Been running a software development company called MacGyver Tech, focusing on building custom software for companies. And now in our latest leg is doing a lot more AI implementations, AI agent work, automating workflows for companies. And really, AI is just another extension for software. From my standpoint, you know, we still have to be coders to make it work right and stop AI from misbehaving.
And for those who are listening and not watching this on YouTube or somewhere else, Mac's background, he's got 3 monitors, 2 keyboards, some records on the wall, you know, some other audio devices. So you also have a background in music production as well, correct?
I do. And yes, yeah, I guess you're not seeing, I actually have 5 27-inch monitors here. You only see a few of those and you only see a few of the keyboards, but there's more stuff here and there's a mixing board on the other side. So I have a full music production studio here too. So on my free times, I do work on music. I am a published musician. I'm registered on the ASCAP and BMI. And I probably put about 15 songs over in my career with small record labels. And, you know, see that one record on the wall. It's one of many. That's a 12-inch vinyl. It's funny. They were going to go away for a while, but now they actually outlive CDs. It seems like, you know, I did a lot of EDM music. I DJed all over the world, known as DJ MacGyver. And, you know, it was very humbling. A lot younger version of myself did that. You know, I was probably not too smart in business. But, you know, I still get a chance to work with some famous people in the music industry. One of my friends is Scott Page from Pink Floyd. He's their saxophone player. You know, I get a chance to jam out with those amazing people. But that's not kind of my fun stuff. You know, I trade one keyboard for another. You know,
there you go.
An easy way to put that.
So we'll talk about more about the music in a little bit because it's so fascinating, all the places that you've gone and the things that you've done. But I really want to talk about AI. And you referenced before we came on about the failure rate of people implementing AI systems. Can you talk about what you're seeing in the industry and how people are trying to test and implement and experiment with AI?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Yeah, nobody's ever heard of that word AI, right? Didn't he play basketball or something at some point, I think? You know, anyways, but AI is really kind of like, I guess, catching up to the business world. It's no longer like ChatGPT. And what's happening now is you got all these IT folks and these really smart people that think AI is just another technology they can kind of go into and try to do this thing called DYI AI, I guess you would say. And I think MIT just a few days ago released a report about 95% of those types of projects are failing due to the complexity, the needs for those. They're not like, you know, people think is look up a couple things and use AI to make AI. But there's considerations in hardware, and it's kind of funny. I used to do crypto mining, and I was building these really high-end graphics machines that had all these GPUs in it. It's kind of the same thing with AI. You got to have to build these. Instead of mining for Bitcoin, you're mining for truth. And they take all these really powerful graphics cards that have to take a whole lot of power. Just one of those is fine, but most of these require many of them working together in a machine. So these IT guys and technical people are struggling not just to get the hardware working, but then get the software on top of that, which is, it's like speaking Klingon. Like literally once you get the AI working, then you're like, okay, I need to make a RAG system or an AI I can talk to with my own data. That is a whole world on its own, and how you embed the data and how with this and that, it can be overwhelming. So a lot of these are failing, and then you get it working for one person. You got a company. I mean, what do you stand in line to use the AI? Like, it's like, so there's a lot of, I think it's 95% of those implementations are failing right now. It's due to a lot of stuff. So there are specialty companies that are focusing just on AI. We're partners with one of them called Krista AI, which is trying to become a Salesforce of AI. I think like Jarvis for a company, which I think is really fantastic. And they're kind of trying not just to solve little small problems, but holistic, what does it look for a company? So we're doing implementations for them as in a partner because we do custom software. A lot of times we have to touch all these systems and figure things out in the company as a custom software development shop. We are also doing development of AI, but we're also make sure we're doing small use cases, make sure you can get a win, make sure it's suitable, and try to avoid those pitfalls I was mentioning earlier. We're just doing this day in, day out, and we're finding success, but it's not so easy. We struggle as well, but we've been doing it enough times that I think it's just like with anything else. When you do it enough times, you kind of get good at it. And we've been doing this for about 2 years. We started doing it with our existing customers. We also internally do AI. You know, we make sure we're an AI-enabled shop. And now we're doing it at a much higher level for our customers. And we can build small little AIs. And if you want to grow up to something like Krista, you can have full automation and have like your CIO. Think of Jarvis. You know, I think a lot of people remember that from Iron Man, right? But Jarvis was this one AI that was controlling all these other AIs. It's almost like the AI overlord. So
when you said Jarvis, sweat. I thought you were referring to Iron Man. I was hoping so.
I didn't make that assumption.
Yeah. Well, I was like, I think that's what he's talking about. But yeah, okay, I got it.
So you remember Iron Man when he was always talking to him? He's talking to that AI, but that AI in the movie was really, at least in theory, was talking to all these other little AI workers that would do the work for that Jarvis. Jarvis was never doing the work. That's the same thing what you want to have. And it's actually how Krista puts his AI control tower. Like, you need to have an AI that's managing and watching all the other AIs, or otherwise you're just creating calamity. Who's actually in charge?
One thing that jumps out to me that interests me, when you mentioned the failure rate and people struggling with AI, and you mentioned the IT folks and the technically savvy folks that are having trouble with it. A lot of what I'm hearing is, well, number one, there's a fear. Sure. People don't know where to start. And I completely agree with doing pilots and small tests on one thing at a time before you figure out how to scale it. But that really interests me. You saying the technical folks are having a hard time with it.
Well, the thing is, the problem is, I'm a software development shop and some people categorize me as an IT company. We are not an IT company. But it's the IT folks that, they're really smart technically to put computers together, manage them. But I get a lot of jobs from those companies because sometimes they try to do software jobs where they can't do them either. But they think because they had the power of AI, they can start talking to AI to do all the stuff for them. But it's a little bit more challenging than that. Software, I don't know, for whatever reason, it's like an exercise in frustration. It's a break-fix model when you're working on software. Sometimes you feel like the greatest thing since sliced bread, and then you're like, oh my God, I'm horrible. But software is like that. Software, there's so many things that can go wrong in a software thing, and there are a lot of ways you can build it, and probably only a few good ones. It's the same thing, I think, with AI. It can be really temperamental, and you have to kind of know how to work it. And then also it uses a lot of power. And if you're going to do it yourself, there's a lot of considerations on different things. And it just takes a little bit more of, I think, a developer mind, at least when you're controlling and doing the coding of the AI. The hardware, the IT guys can probably put the GPU together and make it work. I would hope so, because that's kind of their world. But it requires both a little of both. So what we are doing, we're actually partnering with companies like that, that'll host and maintain them like in a SOC 2 facility. Or at least at the level of security where people will want it. And we just focus on the software. We just do the coding. We don't want to try to be in the IT business. And I think just staying in your lane is really important and focus on all your strengths.
When you are, because I'm assuming you're basically business agnostic when it comes to software and developing a plan. Are there specific industries that you specialize in or that you focus on?
There's a few. So yes, that's correct. Is doing software, we can do a lot of things, but sometimes we're a lot more effective once we've done it a couple times. We've done a lot in the supply chain area, a lot with distribution companies like Anheuser-Beer distributors, manufacturers, companies that sold to Home Depot, Walmart, and Lowe's. So if a company has lots of things, we probably do well with it. Other things are like we've done a lot in the real estate industry. We've been working with a few real estate companies that have at least a few hundred employees, and then building software to speed up their day, pay out commissions, do that. All the back end work that a company like that would want to need to do on a regular basis, we're facilitating that initially with custom software, but now we're using AI to facilitate some of the laborious stuff of even managing that software.
So when you come into a company and you're working with, you're partnering with a company, what is your first step? What is that roadmap look like? Do they already come to you with, this is our challenge, this is what we're trying to solve? Or is it just, hey, we know this AI is a thing and we want to do this and just show us the way.
Well, I wish they would always know what they want. Most of the times they have an idea what they think they want. Sometimes they're just scribbling on the back of a napkin and saying, hey, you know, we're trying to solve logistical bottlenecks here. But what we do is we do a discovery and audit and an AI readiness. What it's really kind of forcing companies to do is define the processes. They might think they might have them defined. They'll have like a document somewhere to say, hey, this is how we do it. But in practice, they're probably not doing that. And it's forcing companies to really understand exactly how they operate. So we have to kind of have somebody take ownership on that side to do that. Not all of them are ready for that. Part of the challenge is kind of squeezing that information out of them to get them ready to do it. Because AI is great when you know what you're doing. But if you just kind of throw that in there and say, sprinkle AI in my company, that's a good chance of failure. You can't just kind of say, hey, go do solve all my problems without even know what you're shooting for.
Another thing I know that you're deeply involved with is security and cybersecurity. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about your mindset around what that looks like in this day and age?
Well, actually, that's a moving target. No pun intended there. The whole AI space has really changed that a little bit. Now you got the bad guys using AI, and then you got the good guys trying to catch up using AI. So, you know, and then you got a whole thing like, what does AI security mean? You know, and, you know, so from my background, I did a lot of ethical hacking. I done, you know, an expert witness where I would try to find a needle in a haystack for like a company trying to do, you know, things that probably were in the gray area, to say the least, and maybe somewhat illegal against other companies. And now you got whole AI in there, like who's at fault if an AI hacked your system? Is it the person that told the AI to do it, or is it actually the AI at fault? And, you know, like, or if your machine gets hacked and a bad guy puts an AI that's malicious on your machine and it hacks, like, are you at fault because you enabled that? It's kind of a slippery slope. And I also know some insurance guys in the cyberspace, they won't even write in policies for this. They don't even know what to do. So I think the average person like you and me are kind of at risk when it comes to AI threats. And I don't even know what does AI security mean, like, you know. Because AI can start thinking on its own, and you got autonomous agents that are just scouring the internet looking for things and then running themselves. What happens if they discover a website that wasn't supposed to be found and looked at some links and they call that hacking? I don't know. I think it's an interesting time for the AI and security.
So all this stuff is moving so fast and there's so much. Is there a specific website or websites or publications that you're involved with that you stay up to date with what's going on in the world and software and cyber?
Well, a little bit interesting about me is I'm also part of an organization called the FBI InfoGuard. So if anybody doesn't know what it means, is it's a joint venture between the private sector and the FBI to protect American infrastructure. So I get a little bit of heads up on things behind the scenes, what's going on in our internal offices like the FBI and cyber threats that are happening. And my job is to take proactive action on those. I also read a lot and look around and just kind of get from different sources. There's a lot of misinformation out there these days, a lot of AI generated information that might not exactly be accurate or true. You know, AIs are really good at giving you an answer, but if it's truthful or right is another question.
So let's talk about this FBI joint task force.
I'm an active member of that. And ask away.
How'd you get involved with that? Was this part of the hacking?
Sort of, you know, in my journeys, you know, there's a lot of companies that are involved that are in the security space that join it. It gives them, you know, like say I have people come to me all the time, you know, on the side, you know, my company does software, but me personally, when people get hacked or have ransomware issues, they kind of contact me and I can help them. Being a part of the FBI InfoGuard, I can help them get to law enforcement quicker. I know what the law enforcement guys are looking for. I know how to get them, you know, set up with a case that the FBI could take action on. Because one is they're overwhelmed. There's certain thresholds. If you don't meet, they're not going to take on a thing, even if you think they will. It's a different world when just because a crime happened doesn't mean they're going to take action. And, you know, you want to set them up for success if you can. Sometimes the DA might not want to take it, you know. So anyways, I got in this years ago. A buddy of mine, he's a good friend of mine, Austin, and he owns an insurance company in cyber risk and assessment. And he knew I was doing hacking. He's like, hey, you should probably join this organization. It'll probably be good for you. And I spent like a year and a half going through background checks because they're testing everything as me. Like I'm getting like top secret clearance. So I had to go through that whole rigmarole. But then once I got in, I got access to the system. I have a little cool badge number, I guess you would say. And I have access and direct line to the FBI for certain things. I also get all the information from them on a regular basis. And when they tap me on the shoulder, I help them with my nerdy skills. You know, I have a good background in blockchain and cryptocurrencies. They want to know what these Bitcoin things are and why the cyber criminals are asking for them and how to track them down. So they ask me more so than not for those types of things. You know, one time I can't get too much in the weeds, but I was in a Zoom with all the people and generals from Ukraine. And they were like, hey, people are asking about these Bitcoins and what can we do about it? And how can you help me with it kind of deal? It was very intimidating.
Yeah. You know? Okay. Well, yeah. Don't get too far in the weeds. Don't get me wrapped up.
No, but I'm just saying, like, it was an interesting. I get myself in some very interesting situations because of that, and I never thought I would be in a room of people like that. But I don't know. I'm good at certain things, and they can use my help on those things, and I don't mind helping, you know, good people.
Great. Yeah. Don't get me wrapped up. No, I want to know, but I don't want to know too much. It's one of those things.
I don't know. They might have, you might be picked up by a dark van or something like that.
Man, no, I don't need that. I don't need that in my life.
No, I don't think that. I don't think that's going to happen. You're all right.
So let's talk about quantum. Boy. Again, I want to get all these big things out of the way. I want to talk about the music.
You're just going right for the prize here, huh?
Well, last time we talked, because there you have that in the background. For those of you listening on the screen there, you got that.
You mean a little star thing? So that's a mathematical construct.
Can you explain that?
A little bit. So that is a multidimensional construct to do quantum computing.
Can you explain that more?
Oh boy. I don't want to go too much in the weeds, but basically, you know, it's used to see what the relationships are between other dimensions and how they relate to each other. Basically multidimensional mathematics, which, you know, a lot of our math right now really struggles with. So I'm working on ways of making that better. I say because, you know, it's beautiful. I wouldn't even know. I'm not that graphically talented. So that's like a little star. And each of those dots is like a dimension. It's just showing the relationships between those. And I was like, man, the universe is beautiful. Like if you look at it in a certain way. So I don't know. I saved it as a screensaver because I thought it was something that really caught my attention. But just to see how numbers and relationships really form these beautiful patterns. It's like, think about like the Fibonacci sequence and what that really represents. That is like how plants grow. That's how our cells divide. That's how our DNA works. So it's really undercovering the foundation of how mathematics in the universe is working. And that's how the universe works in quantum. And quantum is really the secret of how the universe operates. Us humans have just starting to figure that out. So it's kind of playing in that space. But it's just a visual reminder for me every day to kind of like, wow, the universe can be beautiful, even though there's a lot of ugliness out there.
How much do all these things in your mind relate to one another? It's your day job, you know, your hobbies with the music. Is there a common thread through all these things of math being the underlying or the rhythm or the flow? I've gone down a few very deep YouTube rabbit holes. Wow. And it's like, I love to see these things, but to see what you're doing and what you're actually doing in your work and your hobbies, how much do you actually think about that and how will they relate?
Yeah.
Or how they complement each other if not directly relate?
Well, yeah, maybe I'll put this. So I'm a truth seeker. I love finding the truth of things, no matter what it is. And you know, I think math is truth. Either a math problem is right or it's wrong. There's no like gray area. And so I kind of, you know, it's funny to kind of ask this, like when it comes to, like grammar, I'm dyslexic. I really struggled through school when I was like going to school because I always had trouble with like gray areas. But exactness and numbers have always kind of resonated with me. So I'm always seeking harmony, coherence, and things that have vibrational aspects to them, just like music. I was going to school for electrical engineering. I switched to computer science. But the funny thing is, if you think about numbers, do you know, this might be a really good quiz for anybody out there to think about this. Do you know what a number really represents? Like, kind of think about it that way. Like, what does a zero mean? What does a one mean? And what does a three mean? Like, other than it being a three, what does that three really represent? Do you have any idea? Maybe you want to take a stab at this and see what your thoughts are? Because this will answer the question.
Oh, okay. Let's give this a shot. Is or is not, or is some more?
Well, all right, I'll make it easier. So numbers actually represent the angles in a shape. So zero has no angles. One is a line. Two is an angle. Three is where depth actually forms, and that's why we live in a three-dimensional world. That's a triangle. Four is a square, so on and so forth. So those numbers really represent that angle in a shape. So you can use shapes to solve mathematical problems. Like, if you ever seen, like, you know, and it's going to the music side, you ever heard of a thing called cymatics?
Mm-mm, no.
Cymatics is if you take, like, you know, obviously you see one of my speakers there. So I took that speaker and I put a piece of paper on top of it. And I put
Yes.
Tones and frequencies of each frequency would form a different fractal pattern. Those fractal patterns directly relate to the angles and the shape that I was just mentioning. So the universe really is language is math. And music, numbers function the same in no matter what the medium it is. If it's music, electricity, thematics or dimensions, quantum, all the number itself represents really the quality. So even in atomic weight, there's a reason why atomic clocks are built off of Celsium, which has an atomic weight of 55.
You know, after you described what it was, I didn't know the name of it, but I have seen those videos and descriptions of people putting sand on something and then playing a certain tone.
Yeah, yeah, but those are forming mathematical patterns with the sound. So sound is all about harmonies. And so when you're like with these keyboards, like your first key in your key is a C. That's C1. But you go all the way up one octave, that's C, one octave up. Those same frequencies, it's like your root key, actually what they made is 440 hertz, that's the A key. If you double that, that's 880, that's one octave up. So they have resonance with each other. And it basically, if you play those two keys together, they're going to sound really beautiful together. If you start playing other keys other than with them, it's going to, you know, you're a guitar player, so you're all about vibration. It's the same thing. So those vibration aspects of music are the same thing in electricity and math. And the numbers are really important about those. But there's certain key numbers that have like superpowers. In the quantum world, that's what I'm trying to find is where are those superpower numbers. And how can I work with other superpower numbers to kind of solve problems or help protect things from bad things?
As you said that you were always looking for harmony and resonance, when did you learn this? Like, how old would you say you were when you started to seek this truth and find?
As a kid,
like, oh,
I don't know.
This...
I was always stole my dad's record player and I was trying to play music with the records and stuff. I just and at a younger age, my parents got me a Commodore 64, which was my first computer. I don't know. I felt like there was a truth to that. And I just always wanted to know how it worked.
When you said you're dyslexic, are you?
I'm still dyslexic.
I mean, are you like clinically dyslexic? I didn't know if you were just saying that as like.
I'm clinically diagnosed with ADHD, but I flip things back and forth all the time. But in some senses, that gives me superpowers in pattern matching. You know, I don't see things how people others see it. You know, it just sucks for when I'm writing things. So when I'm learning, I actually listen better. I actually do a lot of audible books. I'm much better at listening than I am actually typing or reading. Mm. But when it comes to math, I don't know. It's like grammar always seems fuzzy to me. Math, this resonates with me, ironically. I don't know what it is. It's just anything math, science-based, physics, you know, string theory, they all sing to me. I just feel like I understand that really easily. But then I might struggle with like common things other people would do.
How old were you when you were diagnosed with dyslexia?
Well, I wasn't diagnosed with dyslexia. I was diagnosed with ADHD. But I just know, I mean, if I went to go get clinically diagnosed, I would know I would pass with flying colors. There's no way around it. I wasn't tested for that because I do it all the time. Everything for my wife, like even when I'm typing dull, I can misspell dull. The way my brain works, it just flips things by accident. Like I'll hear things and I'll hear the two words differently. And I don't know, my brain is wired differently. But I think the ability for me to flip things on a regular basis without actually trying to do it, I think that also gives me pattern matching abilities. Like I can flip things in and out, but I know I have a special skill called asymmetrical thinking with some people that have ADHD that can do that, where I can think about a whole lot of things all at the same time. Like even when I was doing my music and DJing, I can hear two songs and pieces of a song at the same time in my head, like record players independently of each other. And I can put them together and see where they lock.
How old were you when you realized that this is a power? Because I'd imagine when you're trying to do the reading and the grammar and you go through school and, you know, maybe
sure
it doesn't feel right or comfortable, but then how old were you or when was it that you were like,
I can tell you exactly. So I was 6 years old and when I was, they were kind of moving through school and they realized I was really struggling with my reading and grammar and I had a hard time. So they put me in this room that I felt I did not belong in. And this is way back when we had the monochrome colored computers. And for me to leave that room, I had to beat this multi-choice test on the computer to get, you know, a good score in grammar and reading, but it was all multiple choice. I was never going to beat it on its merit. So what I figured out is the algorithm of how the pattern matching of the questions and answers were enabled to ace that 30-minute test in 3 minutes, and they moved me out of that room. Not because I beat the test for what it was meant for. I beat it because of my pattern matching ability.
And you were six? This when you were six?
6 years old, yeah. So I had to do that 6 years old. I did it at a sure will because I did not want to be in that room. I didn't think I belonged in that room. But I was really, like, giving example in high school, I was at AP math and physics, but I was like remedial. But I never was able to get past that point. I couldn't beat them in the long term. But when it came to certain tests and targets of things, I'm really effective at figuring that out. And I guess that also helps me when I do cyber. Think about like the bell curve, you know, the bell curve, you have the center and everybody goes to it and you have the teetering ends. Everybody goes to the center. I immediately don't care what anybody else does. I go to the ends immediately. It's like if I read a book, I go to the end of the book first. I just want to know what the target is. And then I'll jump around in the book. I don't read a book normally. I'll start at the end. I'll go in the middle. Like I jump around. I like trying to just figure things out on my own. And it's made a lifestyle out.
When did you start getting into music? Did you start with a certain instrument at an early age?
I probably started a couple years later, at 8 years old. I started, you know, I taught you to play with a little flute kind of thing. So I kind of did a little bit of music stuff. I was horrible at the flute, by the way.
But the flute or the recorder? Because I remember back in the day.
I think it was recorder, flute, so yeah. Same thing, really. Actually, my kid who's 9 years old just got one and he had to learn how to play it too. So it kind of brought back some fond memories. But I was not so good at the wind instrument. But then I always really had a love for keyboards and pianos, and I started playing around with those. And obviously, you see keyboards behind me now. And it kind of resonated with me a little bit. So I kind of like really went down that road with keyboards. I'm not the greatest keyboard player, but I'm okay. I'm more of an audio producer where I can hear what's not heard and where things need to be. I have a thing, I guess they call it three-dimensional hearing. I just sense where things need to be and the placements of those. And I can put a lot of things together, you know, so working with musicians where I can kind of maximize their value and where they need to be in an arrangement. So it's all about finding harmony, you know, and I think I'm trying to do the same thing with math. I don't know. I just like, it's just sometimes if you just know, you know, sometimes I just do.
Would you say math is generally easy for you?
Yeah, math is, I can like, you know, I guess I'll go back and I'm trying to be humble here. When I was in my AP physics teacher in 12th grade, my AP physics teacher actually wrote me a recommendation. Initially, it was for Rutgers University. I was going to go for electrical engineering. And then I wound up going to Rowan University and was going to transfer there. But I switched my major and stayed. But he said I had the most natural talent of any student he ever taught. So I could just pick up on the fly of things like that. I don't know. I just have a really good ability. Something sings to me with math. It just makes sense to me. And I can just learn it almost as I'm doing it.
You know, you reminded me, my daughter, who's now 14, but when she was in, I believe it was fourth grade or so, she had a classmate who was a math prodigy and a math whiz. And he could see numbers as shapes. Everything you're saying reminds me of what
so,
this kid.
So it's easier to see shapes than it is the numbers, honestly.
And so the teacher, her teacher, you know, because this guy was in my daughter's class, the teacher was like a math major in college and got her master's in mathematical theory or whatever. And she was saying that kid, and I believe it was third or fourth grade, was doing math in his head that she struggled with in college. And he would just like see the number as a shape and could like do this math in his head. And I was like, what? Like, seriously? It's a different thing.
It's visual. If you think of like looking at like, think of like shapes of like little Lego blocks, and you can see this is a square and you can see this is a triangle and you see this is an octagon and you can color code them. You can kind of use that to solve math problems in a way, because really the numbers don't lie. Like they kind of line up. There's a reason why honeycombs are, you know, have that many sides. You know what I mean? A five-sided thing. You know, there's weird things that happen in like astrology, like, you know, on top of like, if you ever seen that satellites go around like the planets, like, you know, Venus and then also Jupiter. If you ever looked at the poles, they're five-sided storm, like clearings. Like they're straight lines. It's really weird. Like, so there's certain shapes and things that show up, and even in like how molecules work together, the fraction of light, how that works. And when light goes through water, happens from a shape of the molecules. Like, it's kind of like when you kind of start seeing it visually, instead of thinking math as being as numbers, you can think of them as shapes. I think it actually kind of makes it easier, but you have to kind of shift your thinking. But to me, I always just, I don't know why it made sense to me. But God made me humble and he made me good at that area. But boy, he took away from the other areas and I had to, you struggle through a lot of things. I think that's the case with anything. Maybe God has like a stack of cards and you have 52. But if you have too many in one stack, you know, you got to take away from another stack, you know? So it's been a very humbling experience for me. You know, when I was younger, more ego driven, I was like always able to kind of do all these great things. And then, you know, I didn't realize until I was older that there's a lot of things I was not so good at. You know, my wife always says I'm like, you know, dumbest smart person. You know what I mean? I smart and can solve problems, but they don't have common sense, you know, like everybody else does. So.
Yeah, I had a basketball coach in high school that called me the dumbest smart kid he ever saw.
Yeah, so yeah. You know the feeling, you know? But I hear it on a daily basis, so at least you don't see your coach all the time.
Yeah, so
educational.
Well, no, I love this stuff, and especially, you know, sometimes I'll watch these things online and on YouTube about, you know, the Fibonacci sequence and, you know, just so many things where I'm like, I can't wrap my head around it, but I'm interested in it. And sometimes in my work, in my day job, like I don't go to the office and talk about these things. And that's why when we were talking about AI and commercial real estate, and then you started talking about frequencies and these things, I'm like, go on. Like to the Venn diagram of these things, of like the work and these things. And so that's why I'm talking to you. And sometimes I talk to people that do understand, or at least are on that path to trying to understand these things or are interested in them. It's really fun for me, because then we can just talk about all of these things.
Yeah, man. And Fibonacci is nothing to be scared of. It's actually just how trees grow. I mean, that is a number. It's really simple formula. All you're taking is first two numbers, add them together. And then the next two, add them together, and then add them together. But what's interesting, they form specific patterns based off the golden ratio. And the ancients knew, I think, honestly, the ancients knew more about math than we do today. We've kind of created things like pi in irrational mathematics, and we kind of use decimal points and floating points, where all the ancients use ratios and fractions, and it's a ratio of this over this. Like, good example of like 1/3, we equate to 0.33333, but we truncate that 3. But that 3 in the universe needs to keep going. And the ancients knew this, so they combined math, they combined philosophy, religion was all one. And I think as humans, we kind of got away from that. And I think, like, give an example, the Parthenon in Greece is built off the golden ratio all over that building. The pyramids in Giza are built off the golden ratio and things like that. They show it off in the sarcophagus rooms, the doorways, like they purposely showed their excellence in mathematics. And we still today couldn't build a pyramid like that if we wanted to. So I think the ancients knew some things, and us as humans, we kind of got away from the natural world and our connection with it. And I think they were more connected with it. And even when I'm doing this multidimensional mathematics, I'm actually cross-referencing ancient math and the Sumerians and the Egyptians and the Greeks, and they're singing the same tune of the same song. Like there's certain numbers that keep showing up, and they had a connection I think we lost here in today.
So I think that's my question. Like when you think, do you relate them directly to your work?
100%. Like what I've been building is an AI agent with all this information I'm dumping in. I have like 2 million documents of my findings, but then I'm also overlaying it all the Sumerian mathematics. I'm trying to get an overview of humanity and what it's done with math and some of the gaps that we have. It seems like we try to come up with this more modern math that is probably disconnected from the universe math. And that's probably why, like right now, there's a couple quagmires of math, especially in the quantum and classical world. Like they can't have the classical world of mathematics and the quantum world of mathematics. Like they don't intermingle. They're like incompatible in our current math. But the universe isn't incompatible. It just works. You know, the universe would say, oh, sorry, I can't go any further. It just, you know, things turn from atoms into the things, into life. But us as humans, I think, are still struggling with math, because I think our math is very one-dimensional and the universe is multidimensional. That's with all those new quantum computers you see by Microsoft. They actually made a new state of matter just to kind of do quantum computing. And you got Google making these D-Wave machines. They're actually accessing all space and time and dimensions at the same time. That's the only way they operate. So they're actually showing us that there's another whole level of existence that we don't even know, that's we're a part of. It's crazy.
Yeah, but
it's crazy. It's like Doctor Strange for real, right?
Yeah, no, it's amazing, and I love thinking about it. Even though I don't fully understand it, it's just I'm in awe of it. I remember the first time, and maybe you can explain this deeper for the audience, but the first time I saw the Mandelbrot set visualized, you know, the self-similarity where you just keep zooming in and further in and goes in.
You mean fractal?
Yeah, but there's a specific set called the Mandelbrot set.
Where, oh, I don't know if I've seen that.
Oh, yeah, you have. You're going to see it and be like, oh.
So you go, you're going to teach me something today. I love it.
Like, it's basically the concept of, like, it's self-similarity. So, like, the further you go in, it's just the same thing over and over and over. So you can just keep going, and it just never ends because it's just an equation. And when you visualize
it. That's the basis of quantum, really.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just like, man, I wish I could understand some of this stuff, but it's also good.
You gotta be curious. Honestly, most of the things I'm learning, I taught myself. There's so much information out there. You gotta be willing to learn and look, you know, and there's a lot of smart people out there. Yeah. You know, I know the world's not really embracing the smartness, but there's still pockets of people want to see, you know, this type of stuff. I think I'm just fascinated. I like harmony. I like coherence. I like things that just kind of like, it's like you ever have like, what's really cool is I have tuning forks and I actually do this thing called vibrational sound healing where I use certain frequencies of tuning force and I can heal. Like I've done it a couple times to myself and to others. And there's a weirdness about those frequencies that, like, if I get a tuning fork and I had this thing called a boot that you kind of put on the end of the tuning fork and you put it on, like, if you put it on the edge of your spinal cord, it ripples that frequency through your entire electrical system, through your entire nervous system. I've healed people's pain, emotional stuff. I had people break down and start crying in front of me. Like, there's a magic about those frequencies. And what's interesting, I have a couple cats and a dog, and I put them on the cats and the dogs, and you would think they would be terrified of this. They actually really like it. There's like there's certain frequencies, like even cats when they purr, that frequency of the purring at a cat actually is like a cosmic frequency. Like, you know, there's a lot of weird things that, like, when you start looking at nature, like nature has figured some things out, and if you can replicate that, why reinvent the wheel?
What is the frequency of the tuning fork that you have?
So I have a whole it's called a Sphygidio set, but the most there's
God bless you.
Yeah, I
what's it called?
So Sphygidio sounding.
Oh, Sphygidio. So, okay, got it.
So, and that's based off of a lot of stuff. So I'll even show you a little bit here. You know, I'll get a little nerdy here. So I have the whole set, and it's all based off the Kundalini frequencies. 55 is your base frequency. So funny that you mentioned. Remember, I said 55 before. Yeah. So that shows up in Kundalini. That's your base chakra. It's 55 hertz, ironically. So it's like weird, like how these numbers. And 55 is the 10th Fibonacci sequence number. Ironically. So, but this right here is 174 hertz. So this is kind of a cool little thing. You see like the thing, but you see this little boot on it. So this is a Canadian hockey puck. So I didn't actually go out of the way to figure this out. There's a lady called Elaine McCusick who pioneered this type of technology. She actually wrote a book called Attuning the Human Biofield. And my buddy introduced me to it and it really resonated with me, ironically. And this is 174 hertz, by the way. And 174 hertz is a little unique. It's not on a Sphygidio set, but she in her book mentioned that this is probably one of the most effective for sound healing. But there's other ones like 432. 432 is a cosmic, you know, number all over. You see it everywhere. But this one in particular is just really effective. And I have this one as a special one, but I have the whole set. But this one, 174, for some reason, has some super magical powers. And she mentioned the Canadian hockey pucks are better than the little strikers you get. So, you know, I bought this, you know, it actually says made in Canada. It's actually made of rubber. So the American ones suck because they're plasticky. So anyways, but this, when you kind of hit these things here, those frequencies, they're soothing. They kind of like, there's something about this and it just, you know, it just works.
And so when you said you put it on your neck.
Oh, yeah. You just put it on the back here. I'd put it like back here, on the spinal cord.
But you hit it with the puck because of what the puck is made out of?
Yeah, because these are the rubber and the puck actually is a little bit better striker. They give you little rubber strikers. They're kind of silly. But this, she said, even in her books, these are best things. So I bought it. Oh. And, you know, I bought the whole set and I have all these. And occasionally I help people, this not charging them. I basically help them with, you know, their things. And it's interesting. It's like a two-way street. I feel an energy transfer. I feel like I'm helping them in a way. And then within like 2 or 3 minutes, they're like, wow, my leg no longer hurts. My back's not in pain anymore. Because when you actually run it through and put that little boot on like one of your spinal, vertebrae, that vibration travels through your entire nervous system. And it just kind of, I don't know, kind of fixes things. So I really believe in that vibrational sound healing. And I think it's also like with music too, like music is vibrations. And, you know, giving an example, I used to do a lot of DJing. I also DJed in Philly. I did a lot of EDM stuff. So EDM stuff, you don't hear a lot of people getting killed or shot or anything like that. But you go to clubs or to more negative music, I think the music infects the people there and changes their vibration, and it causes them to do more bad things. Just like with beautiful piano music and beautiful music can up, there's that vibrational aspect of the music and the tones. And that's why I said, it's like those things just speak to me in a way that other things don't. I'm a super nerd in that.
Well, let's talk about, because I feel like a lot of these things are,
it's all related.
It's all related. Spirituality. Like how you mentioned like Kundalini and chakras, yeah. Like you're talking about these things. Would you consider yourself a spiritual person, religious?
I would say
any
so.
Of those things?
I even have it. I have a Tibetan singing bowl here, one of those big bowls too. I hate it as a lot too. I've also do a lot of meditation. I think honestly, a lot of the meditation stuff is all the same. You're all shooting for the same stuff. All religions, all higher level consciousness are really shooting for connection to the source. And I don't know. I have a weird thing. When I was 2 years old, I died and drowned in an in-ground swimming pool. And I don't know. I've always had a weird connection to afterlife. And I feel like this life is not the beginning and the end. You know, not everybody might think that. But I feel like there's more to this world than what we see. And I think we're eternal souls. And I don't know. I just feel like, I guess I am a spiritual person. And I'm here to bring harmony from chaos, you know. And I try to, that's why maybe I'm into music and I'm into the math. And I feel like I'm trying to create some order in a disordered world. But the meditation, I've also done this thing called the hemisynchronization, or hemisync, they call it. The Monroe Institute created it, and they work with the government or the CIA to create meditation as a weapon. And they actually spend an exorbitant amount of effort trying to figure out what is the common bond between higher level of consciousness and religions. And then they created a meditative program around it. Ironically, they're using harmonic frequencies and binaural beats, if you ever heard of those types of things, where you wear headphones. And what they'll do is they'll play these tones and then it'll offset them by about 7 or 8 hertz. So it's ironic about that frequency. That's a Schumann frequency. That's the frequency of the earth. So when lightning strikes the earth, it creates that Schumann frequency, which is 7.81. That is the same frequency they're using in hemisync that sync you into the cosmic field. So the hemisync is crazy. This is the CIA, by the way. They talk about, show you how to basically separate your mind from your body, how to go into the ether, how to do things of remote viewing and astral projection. And this is the CIA. And this is in 1983. And they're talking about quantum. And I think they're all interrelated. And, you know, we are quantum computers. We're kind of like Neo in the Matrix, I guess you would say. And well, consciousness drives this world.
If they're working on this in 1983 and knowing this, do you feel or do you think or do you know?
I don't know.
That they have I don't know. You work with this FBI task force. You know everything
about
CIA. Yeah,
but I'm not that kind of guy. You know, they don't tell me everything. You know, it usually comes from the top down.
Do you think that there's things that the government knows or has at their disposal that are just way farther than what we currently?
I mean, if this is over 50 years old, and what they were doing with this, they were actually using meditation as a weapon. They were using this to remote view and astral projects. The Russians and the Chinese were highly effective. So what this program does, it speeds up the meditative process. Like Buddhist monks and people of high level of you know, spiritualism get to a certain point, even priests and stuff. They get to a certain connection and they can speed that process up with this, give anybody super meditative powers in about a month or so. Instead of spending 20 years, you can get up to speed in that short amount of time. But they teach you how to go in this world that we see, as this humans only see a small band of electromagnetism, which is light. And then there's other dimensions that Google, Microsoft are proven that real. You're really just accessing those when you kind of go into that meditative state.
What was your introduction to meditation? Because you mentioned that it's something that you do. Like, what was your introduction and what is your practice? How do you do it?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I've had some friends that just were kind of get me into the mindfulness space many years ago. And then I went down a rabbit hole and kind of just did all this stuff to learn more about it. You know, me being a neurodivergent, you know, one of my weaknesses is emotional intelligence. I always had a hard time figuring out how other people operated. And sometimes I would misread people. So I went on this mission of learning about stoicism and learning about, you know, just how people operate. And I also was understanding about meditation and going on reading all these meditative books and stuff. And they're all really, they're all singing the same thing. You're all talking about the same thing. This is a different way. Even all religions, I think, are really shooting from the same target, even though on this earth, people kill for their God. But God's all one. It's all the same. You know, it doesn't care what your religion is. You know, it's like, I think God's not exactly what we think it is either. What happens if God's just all positive energy and the devil's just all negative energy? And, you know, they can't live without each other. And, you know, you kind of think about it philosophically like that, I guess.
Yeah. So in your meditation practice, like, how does that look? Like, what do you do? When do you do it? How long do you do it for?
So, you know, your best times actually to do meditative stuff is when you're in an alpha state. Usually, ironically, when you dream at night, you're kind of going into an alpha state. But when you just wake up and when you're just about to fall asleep, you're kind of going in that in-between state. That's when you're kind of in an alpha state. So that's your best time. So what I do is interesting. I have a ritual I do every morning and every night. And I have my intention to universe. So my intention to universe, I talk to my family, the things I want to do and what I want to accomplish. Then I have all these mantras that I get from the yogis and other ones. It's about a 3.5 to 4 minute run through. I record it and I play it to myself while I'm in the shower. Because when I'm still in the shower, I'm still waking up and in an in-between state. And it's just like being grateful, being in a moment. Like if you if you wanted $1 million, right? So the universe doesn't care how or if it's going to give you or not. The universe doesn't give a crap. But the universe cares about intention. So if you want that $1 million, how you want it and get it is what you do is you force the universe to manifest that towards you. It's like the secret is the best way to put it. You ever seen this movie? So when you have that $1 million, what is your emotional state and how do you feel? What does the money feel like in your hands? What does it smell like? What does the day look like? Like, give an example. One of my intentions is, you know, I want to be in a cruise with my family. So when I'm on that cruise with my family, I'm already visually there in my mind. I can feel the water hitting my things. I can feel the sunshine hitting me as if I'm there. And I can even tell you the brown shirt of the guy walking past me when I'm on the deck. Like, I'm already playing it as a movie as I'm there. And I'm manifesting that to come to me. So does that make sense? It's like you got to, like, your consciousness actually can manifest what you want. And there's a book called Think and Grow Rich, if you ever heard of it. Mm-hmm. It's the secret for business, but they're all telling the same thing. It's got to start in here and then you manifest that. But if you tell that to the universe enough ways and put your intention as if you have it in present tense or gratitude and a high level of motion, the universe will bring that to you.
So one of the things that, especially when it comes to meditation, and, you know, in my practice, one of the things I try to do as part of the practice is be present. And
that's right.
And just let go, because the thoughts come, whether it's thinking about the future or that cruise or whatever, or I did that thing and I shouldn't have done that, and or worried about something, you know, worried about the past or the future and all those things.
Yeah,
or,
no, what that you can't do either of those.
But being able to identify that, oh, that's happening. It's not a good or bad thing. It's just happening. Let go, come back. And then that's so part of me is like, when it comes to like wanting things or picturing things or manifesting things, for me, I guess it's something that I wouldn't even say wrestle with. It's not even like a thing, but sure. I think about it like, yeah, I want those things, but I don't attach to them. You know, it's like, that's so how long do you stay there? And you do like, oh, I want that. I want that. Is it like an effort thing or just a is thing?
So you actually contradict yourself there. So the universe will never give you what you want. It gives you what you are. You can't want. Wanting is instantly not getting it. It's like, think about it when you're in high school and you had that girl that you really liked. As soon as you wanted her, you lost her. It's weird like that. So like, give an example, like I'm into sports and stuff like that. And I watch like the football games and baseball games. So if I like, say I'm a Philadelphia, you know, fan, so I'm in Philly. So if I want the Phillies to win, right? I never say I want to win it to myself or anything else. What I say is I'm grateful to be part of them winning. It's almost detachment. Like, you can't attach yourself to something as you want it. That's the key. You almost think of it as a pendulum. You just want to watch it happen and almost be a passenger in it and not attach yourself to the want.
So I think that's my
problem.
I think that's my question about with the manifesting. Like, so when you're talking about,
it's not wanting, because I am it. I'm mentally putting my mind there, not as a want, as if I have.
Hmm.
It's a difference. It's like that guitar behind you. You didn't want that guitar. You just felt you need. It was who you are. You were with the guitar. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, the wanting part is the problem. And I think a lot of, and also not wanting something's the problem too. It's like, if you don't want something to happen, you're going to attract that right to you. The universe is a funny thing. It's kind of like, it's almost a trickster. It's like, it's kind of like, it'll play games with you. So you can't like, you almost be like, but you, if you really want something, you have to do a high level of emotion. Like I have a whole little intention thing. It's like, do a high level of emotion. As if you have it and you're already there and being present of that moment, like you're zooming into that time that you have it already. And then the universe is going to pull that right towards you. And if you could think about that way, otherwise you're kind of like, you're a victim of your own world and you don't even realize what your subconscious is doing. Because we have two sides of your brain. That's what the whole hemisync does. It synchronizes it together. One side, I think it's your right-hand side of your brain, is your filter. But the other side is your where your subconscious is and more free thinking, but your filter is always like, no. But that's when you go to meditation, you kind of relax that side to allow you have a more free flowing of things. But like, just think of like the wind with the leaves, just let the things of past, don't have any attachment to anything. And then if you see something you really like, oh, that's great. It's awesome to have it, but don't want it. And that's kind of, I think, the secret of a lot of these books and things that I do and how I'm going about my journey. You know, and it seems to resonate with me.
Yeah, it's a concept of it's embrace but don't attach. That's the way I like to think of it.
Not just embrace, like appreciate, like the opportunity that the universe gave you that thing, and be thankful for it. But don't be like, oh my God, I got to have it. You know, like a lot of people want money, but they don't realize by that wanting of money, they're actually pushing that way.
I don't want that million dollars. I don't want that million dollars anymore then, I guess.
Well, no, don't say you want to. Say, you know what, I would love to have it to help do things with it. Like, think of being grateful and what you are with it. And I think, you know, being one with whatever it is, you know, like even the book Think and Grow Rich I brought up before, I read that book more than any other book about 30 times. And the common bond that they interviewed over 10,000 business leaders like Thomas Edison, Henry Ford. And the common bond was they all thought and manifested what they want. It doesn't matter how smart they are, where they came from, their background. Honestly, most of the people that were extremely successful came from nothing. They already saw themselves. Like, there's this guy Barnes in the book who wound up being partners with Thomas Edison. And when he was a teenager, he had no money. He took the train with the animals and cattle in New Jersey just to go see himself, the Thomas Edison. And he put himself in front of Thomas Edison. He's like, I'm going to be partners with you. And Thomas Edison didn't think, you know, he's like, oh, he can be my intern. He can go work for me and do some stuff in a thing. But no, he really meant that. Like, he knew that he was going to be partners with Thomas Edison, hell or high water. So he waited around, worked for him for a little while, and an opportunity showed up, and he took that opportunity, and next thing you know, became his best friend for many years, and he was a true partner of Thomas Edison. Like, he demanded the universe. It's like, you know, I guess the best way the universe works, if you've ever been at the casino and you have the wheel and spin it, imagine if you're willing to put everything in your entire life onto the one number, everything you have, no matter what else is important, and you believe in that so much. The universe actually will reward you for those people. A modern day version of that is, watch baseball, is Ohtani. You know, Ohtani with the Dodgers. You know who he is. He's a really famous baseball player now.
I'm a Padres fan, so I know him all too well.
So you probably hate his ass then.
I don't think I hate anybody, but yeah, I get tired of them winning.
You know what I mean? But anyways, so here's what I appreciated about him. Beginning of his rookie season, he says, I'm going to be the first person to get the 50 and 50. 50 home runs and 50 stolen bases. He put it out there in the universe and demanded that he was going to get it and was not going to relent until he got it. That's the same kind of power that I'm kind of talking about here. It's like the universe knows if you're bullshitting. You know, it knows. It knows. Like, it's like, if you really want something, look yourself in a mirror and really, really dig into like who you are and what you really want. Most people will have a hard time doing that. But you have to get over that part. You have to really know who you are.
What does that mean for you? Where do you want to go, or maybe not want to go? Where do you appreciate?
Honestly, you know, big part of my career. I was into music and I thought I was really good at music. I played for thousands and thousands of people, some of the biggest events around. And I always thought I was going to be really famous for my music, but I always did it for the wrong reasons. I did it for an ego-driven mindset. I just wanted to be famous kind of thing. And I thought I was really good at what I did and I was better than my peers. But the universe had a different path for me. And I didn't realize it until I got into this quantum space. And I took most of my career, I did a lot of computer software and hacking and stuff, but not real true like quantum stuff. And then I got exposed to this type of math and I knew that there was just something about this that I had to do this. And it wasn't about me. It's about me doing this to help maybe bring humanity forward, maybe to help people that need it. It's like, I just felt like I was here almost like a knight in shining armor, I guess you would say, to hear that maybe I'm giving some insight on something that I need to keep looking into. And now I'm trying to do this to really hopefully make the world a better place and safer. You know, like if I was going to do real, you know, like think about like E=mc². When Einstein created, he had no idea it was going to create the atomic bomb. He would have never created it if he knew that. But I feel like this type of technology also can do those types of things too. It can do bad. My instinct is to do good and help protect people and create something of great good to help and others. I don't know. I just feel like that's my calling.
Yeah.
So well, I'm kind of going fantastic. With it.
No, I love it.
And I'm honestly honored to have that opportunity, you know, that the universe like chose me to have me to be part of something like this. I'm extremely humbled and honored and at all that, you know, I don't think I'm worthy. I don't think I'm that smart.
How much do you talk about these other things in like a business setting?
Oh, well, I mean, if I start talking about some of these things in business sense, I guarantee I lose most people. And, you know, it's always not like good, like, you know, like your water cooler talk, you know, like you start bringing these types of things, like they're going to see you like Klingon talk and they're going to see you as like a Dungeons and Dragons guy. You know, these guys don't always do so well in conversation. So I have to nerf it a lot. But if I find unique people like yourself that I can nerd out on, you know, I don't mind opening the floodgates. And I hope I didn't do that too much today.
Dude, I love it. So I appreciate it.
I love that fact that you love it, man.
Yeah. So, I mean, hopefully this is, so I know we're at time right now. Listen, I would love to have you come back on. And there's so many different things, like, you know, nature and music and AI and quantum. Like I would love to have you back on and really explore all these things because I don't feel like an hour is enough.
Yeah, I would like that too. I think we're just getting started, and I don't know. I just like creating harmony. I also like educating people too and understand that I think there's a harmony to this whole world and universe. And I think sometimes you just have to slow down and take a deep breath and understand that there's a natural rhythm to all this stuff that I think, you know, like the best thing is like, I guess you would say you want to be in the flow state. And when I did music, and I know, I think you, did you say you did martial arts or something like that? I think you did some stuff like that. Or did you do that?
No.
Okay.
No, I did a little taekwondo when I was young, not for very long. My dad got me.
But you go into a little bit of flow state when you do that.
Yeah. Yeah. No. I completely agree with that. Like the flow state in many things. And again, with the meditation practice, like once you're there and you know it exists and it's like trying to find other ways to get there, whether it's sports, music, even doing work, even just in a conversation, watching a movie, like there's so many different ways of just come into that state. And once you know it's there, it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. I mean, I experienced a lot of that when I was younger, my music, like when I got to play for thousands of people, there's just a flow. Like I was just doing stuff subconsciously. I didn't even know what I was doing. Like even sometimes when I'm doing this math, I'm in a flow state. I had to go back to see what the heck I did. Like it's almost a subconscious kind of a flow thing. And I think when you get to that, no matter what you do, either high level or sports people, like there's just certain things and certain people that just go into a zone that others just can't compete, you know? And I think that's when you're kind of in a natural flow state and you're kind of like flowing like water, like, and the universe is kind of like, you know, if you have obstacles, you just kind of bob over it. You know what I mean? It's like no thing where other people get caught up on those things, you know?
Yeah. And you know, I wouldn't say it's exclusive to proficiency, but I found like, especially in sports, and I'm sure it's the same and with music.
It's almost any high level of thing, I think.
Well, but it takes a level of proficiency to, you know, let's use basketball, for example. You spend so much time doing drills and dribbling the ball and then shooting. These are your mechanics and everything. And once you get to a certain level of proficiency, then you don't have to think about dribbling or shooting or this. You're just doing
it.
And one of the best examples of that, I would say, you know, during the Warriors when they were playing, you know, they're on their championship run, on their dynasty run, they were playing like flow. Like the whole team seemed like it was flowing. And it was one of those things where I'm a Sixers fan. Well, first of all, I'm an Eagles.
Unfortunately, I'm sorry to say.
It is.
Like being a Sixers fan, oh my God, it's a heartbreak hotel.
I know, but I mean, I'm all Philly sports, so I'm Eagles, Sixers, but baseball, I'm Padres. I've been lived in San Diego for long enough.
Padres still doing pretty good this year, right?
Yeah, they are. I mean, you know, again,
they might not make it through to the playoffs.
Yeah, those Dodgers.
What a mess this last little bit. Oh my God, it's embarrassing. Oh my God, what's wrong with them?
All right, but hey, listen, Mac.
That is a pleasure, man.
Thank you so much. Could you I will put everything in the show notes, your website, but where can people find you?
Easy to find me in a couple places. I'm on you know, LinkedIn. You can look me up, Stephen P. McKinn, you know, at LinkedIn. Also my company, MacGyverTech.com. If you go there, all my socials are at the bottom there. I'm also on Twitter too. It's my old handle, my version of my company, which is MacGyver Media. I have quite a bit of followers there, but I kind of been boring. That's become a little bit of a cesspool lately in the tone. But yeah, I'm pretty easy to find. You'll provide all those links and stuff like that for anybody that wants to get a hold of me.
Everything will be in the show notes. Well, listen, it's been a pleasure, and I look forward to many more. Thank you, Mac.
Absolutely. Thank you.